Struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Hey, welcome to the show. I'm here today with Sarah Olivieri. How are you doing, Sarah?
I am quite well. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing wonderful. I'm upright, which is, you know, first and foremost, the most important part of the day. If I'm not upright, it's all over. So I'm upright, feeling good, sun is shining. I'm assuming I'm in my cave recording this here with you today. You're from Pivot Ground. Tell us what you do with Pivot Ground, Sarah.
Yeah, so I call myself a nonprofit business consultant, which I think I may have made up, which is a terrible thing. That should totally be something that lots of people call themselves. I used to be an executive director. I shifted out of nonprofit work and into marketing, created Pivot Ground originally as a marketing agency specifically for nonprofits, built up that business, and then quickly discovered most nonprofits couldn't really handle great marketing. And what they really needed was a way to run better so that they could scale what they were doing and make a bigger impact without getting stuck or feeling super overwhelmed struggling with burnout. And so at that point, I said, I know how to solve this problem or I can solve this problem. And I had learned a bunch of frameworks in the for-profit space that really helped for-profits do this, but none of them would really work for nonprofits. So I created the impact method, which I'm sure we'll get into later, and shifted Pivot Ground from a marketing agency to a business consultancy. And that's most of the work I do now, everything around helping nonprofits run better. And I just absolutely love doing the work.
Oh, yeah. You and I are in the same business. It's our mission to help the helpers do what they're doing and do it better. You know, growing up, I was the recipient of those services, and that's one of the reasons that I want to do what it is that I'm doing. So I definitely appreciate what you're doing here today. And I'm loving the background. We've got the fire cans, the oil cans, a bunch of different books, and I don't know, some kind of basket on the top shelf. It looks like it's for trick-or-treating, but I imagine it's not.
Oh, yeah, that's a ceramic teapot made by the former owner of my house.
Yep, never would have got that. I never would have had that one figured out, but... Yeah. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the impact method? It seems like a solid framework for people to build off of. We'll get into all the finer points, but like, what is it?
Yeah. So essentially it's a set of processes and tools, and people often go processes. We don't like those, but processes are simply just ways of doing things in the impact method. So there are three areas that the impact method focuses on, but before I even tell you about those, when I set out to create the impact method, I said something like this will only work for nonprofits if it's really easy and fast to learn and do, because they're already super busy. And what I knew from my own experience in nonprofits and working with nonprofits is like, you have to board their moving train, and it's moving pretty fast. Like, they're not going to stop and pause, because for the most part, people's lives are on the line. And these are a group of helpers. Like, they're just not going to stop helping. They're ready to like open up their veins and give their life's blood to help the people that they're helping. So besides being really effective, I also tried to make it as simple and straightforward as possible. So like, what is it, right? So it's a set of three areas: of processes for improvement, actionable strategy, and modus operandi. Those might sound like fancy words, but when people talk to me, like, I'm kind of known for like, there's the big thinking, but I am totally unsatisfied with any big thinking that doesn't have like a really concrete action as far as a next step. So when I talk about process of improvement, we're talking about three types of meetings with fixed agendas. But in the impact method, I just give you the agenda. So you put the meetings in your calendar and you follow the agenda, like nuts and bolts. That's how you're going to have an amazing process of improvement.
So what I'm still in the Navy. We have, everything has a process. There's process, how to do this. There's a checklist. There's the theory behind it. There's the step one, step two, step three. And then there's the process for process improvement. How do I do this? How do I change this? How do I formally go about the method of testing this new thing and implementing it. So what are these meetings that you've got to have? I know a lot of people don't like adding briefs to the day because they're never brief, but what are these things?
Sure. Well, when it comes to a process of improvement, you know, you have your highest level way of improving, which are your strategic goals, right? You can set your strategic goals, you can review your progress on them, and then you can change them based on what you learned since the last time you reviewed them. So there is a strategic planning meeting, which we call a cycle renewal in the impact method. One of the ways that makes the process of improvement work is instead of looking at your strategic plan like every 3 years, in the impact method, we work on your strategic plan every 2 months. So we're always looking at the data that we created from the previous 2 months and what we've learned. And we're never in this like timeout moment where we have to spend 6 months updating our strategic plan. We're just always updating it, always working on it. And it's like a living, breathing thing that everybody who's running the organization is involved with. So we have that kind of meeting every 2 months to update the strategic plan. We break the work of what we're doing next in the strategic plan into 60-day cycles. So we're going to like work for 60 days and on a work plan. So in that cycle renewal meeting, we actually create the work plan for the next 60 days. But we break, right? A cycle of improvement is about taking action and then stopping to review. It's and then making adjustments based on what you learn. It's as simple as that. So we have our big strategic loop. And then inside that strategic loop, we have tactical loops. And so we break 60 days into 4 2-week sprints. And so every 2 weeks, we're looking at our plan of action. And so we have what we call a sprint renewal meeting, where we looked at what happened in the last 2 weeks, what do we have to change in our plan, and what are, you know, make sure we're still on track or we have an updated plan for the next 2 weeks. So now you're not going to get lost with your strategic plan. There is no such thing as a strategic plan sitting on the shelf in the impact method. And you're checking in on the action plan every 2 weeks. So you now have a chance to address things proactively. And you probably know, like, if you can stop reacting to everything and start being proactive, instead of a world of challenges and a ton of fires to put out, you have opportunity after opportunity after opportunity. And I was talking to one of my clients a couple of weeks ago who was doing the impact method before COVID hit. And she shared that her team adjusted for COVID operations in January of last year. January of 2019, her team adjusted because they were just looking ahead. They're like, oh, we see this coming and we're just going to put it into our plan. So there's the cycle meetings, there's the sprint meetings. And then the third kind is an issues meeting. And this is all about tackling the roadblocks that come up in your way. It's a weekly meeting. It replaces, if you have a staff meeting, you can just swap it out for this meeting. It's not an extra meeting. And you're just always looking for issues to come up. And I think, you know, when it comes to improving, it's kind of a mindset shift for some people to, instead of being like, oh, we want to just look nice, to be a team that's focused on what are the issues? We want to know the issues. We want to pull out all the issues because that's how we can proactively improve, by essentially looking for trouble, right? We want to find it before it comes and finds us.
You know, that is a huge part of aviation. Aviation has these ridiculous, I say ridiculous because there's just a vast amount of them, ridiculous cycle of inspections. You've got the daily, you've got the pre-flight inspection, you've got the turnaround inspection, you've got the post-flight inspection, you've got, depending on what type of aircraft, 7, 14, 28 day inspections, 56 day, 114, 256, 224 day, you've got 440, like all these things. And you've got phases. So different phases, they replace different packings, different fittings, they change certain parts. It's all part of this huge preventative maintenance cycle, which is what keeps airplanes flying. There's just so many different pieces that need attention. And if you do it in an order, then you find all these problems before you're in flight. Because when you're in flight, you can't just pull it over and say, we've got a flat and we've got to fix it. When you're in flight and these problems come up, then you realize how important a flight crew is, between the pilots, flight attendants, or anyone else in the back. You know, that's where they really get paid. They don't get paid for the day-to-day stuff, right? That's your insurance policy, that when something does happen, you're able to take action.
Yeah, you know, I love that you used that analogy, because when I named the process of improvement as such, I'm actually a sailboat racer, and boats and airplanes have a lot in common. Although fortunately, boats won't just fall out of the sky, although they can sink, as you know. But I was reading a sailboat racing tactic, a racing book for, you know, people who race sailboats. And the author said, the team that has the best process for improvement will be the team that wins every time. And that's all about, it's about practice. It's about making sure things don't go wrong, because there are so many, just like an airplane, there are so many things that happen on a sailboat, and a lot of them are out of your control. So if you aren't ready for those things, if you aren't looking ahead for those things, what would have been a teeny problem can become a huge problem in the matter of seconds. And it can go from, like, you know, we used to say on the sailboat, it goes from total boredom to complete terror in just a matter of minutes if you're not careful.
It absolutely can. And, you know, when you're learning how to do these maintenance cycles, like for instance, on aircraft, you're like, oh, I just got to go get this thing done. Well, you've missed the purpose. The purpose is to find the problem, to find the thing that's wrong. And although it's going to take more of your time, it's always better to fix it on the ground than when you're in flight. I use like my leadership experience, and we're looking for problems, and we're talking about processes. A lot of people are annoyed with my leadership style initially, because I don't just answer their questions. As they come to me with their problem, their situation, I'm asking them, well, what do you think we should do about it? Because I'm not just a problem, Megan. Don't just bring me your problems. Don't just care about your problems. What do you think we should do about this thing? Well, you're the boss. You should know. I'm like, well, I do know what I would do. But the only way we can find new ways to do things, if I find out how you might solve it. And we might, but the thing I've been doing for 15 years that easily crushes this problem might be the way we end up doing it. But you might find a way to do it better, faster, easier, cheaper than I've ever done it. And I just didn't know the new method. So if I just push my solution on you, that doesn't help you grow, nor does it help you understand my line of thinking. Because if I can train you to think like I do, then you can solve the problem before it gets to my level. And if you can train the people to think like you do, then you can solve it before you get to your level. And now everyone's got the same kind of methodical and process related thinking. All of a sudden, people are coming to you with options to solve a problem, and not just coming to you with a problem.
That is right. That is opportunity right there. If you've got a room full of great thinkers coming to you with options, like, isn't that what we all want? Like, that's what I always want as a leader, is a bunch of people coming to me with options. Like, oh, well, we could go this way or we could go that way. And that is so different from how so many nonprofits are operating. They're just reacting. And they pretty much, by the time they get to the problem, there's only one thing that they even can do. And it's probably not even the most effective thing at that point, or it wouldn't have been the most effective thing. And now it's their only choice. So super, super true. I'm going to actually jump us over. I said there are three areas, process of improvement. And there's one more piece of a process of improvement that I want to mention. And I'm going to jump over to modus operandi, because it has very much to do with what you just said about leadership and getting people to make decisions. But before I jump to that, I don't want to forget to say that the fourth piece of a process of improvement is respite. And it is so important to be well rested, and not just rested, but to let your brain have some rest time, because that's when our brains actually can become creative. And if we don't give our brains some downtime, then we don't have the ability to come up with those great new ideas. So I like to say respite. I don't call it rest. I call it respite. So it sounds different, and it's part of the work. And in the impact method, I teach nonprofits to take 4 weeks of respite throughout the year, in addition to like personal vacation time, but 4 weeks where you're just kind of, maybe you close up shop completely. Maybe you just put everything on minimum. Maybe you stagger it a bit, but you really make sure that people get a chance to like let their minds relax on what's in front of them, so that they can create really great solutions. And I have to say, the more I give myself respite, the more I move my own business forward, because it's when I come up with all the best ideas. You know, before I know it, I'm scribbling away in my notebook or on a napkin, like all those amazing moments of moving an organization forward. They usually come after giving yourself some downtime. But as far as decision making, you know, I'd like to talk about, we were talking about this before we got on, what is your MO, your modus operandi? And part of that is having a really aligned team. And part of it is how you design that team or empower that team. So how do you get an aligned team? Well, you need to be really clear on who you are as an organization. You have to have a clear mission. You have to have, I like to set a single core belief. Sometimes there are two core beliefs, a set of guiding principles, a vision for the future, right? So that you know if your nonprofit was a person, you know what kind of person that is, right? What kind of character they have, the way they go about the world. Are they Robin Hood? Do they, you know, that's a really clear kind of helper character. Robin Hood is maybe your Mother Teresa instead, right? Robin Hood and Mother Teresa are kind of different types. So you should kind of know what your unique character is. Once you know who you are, you can go about building or sometimes letting go of some team members so that they really, that they're like, yes, I identify with that character. I'm ready to kind of embody that myself and help the organization live it out. Once you have an aligned team, though, what do you do with those people? And there are a lot of ways you could organize people, but I really advocate for pretty much exactly what you were talking about. I call it distributed leadership, which is essentially distributing the power to make decisions. Because the truth is, if you bottleneck all the decision-making, let's say through your executive director, or maybe through a very small handful of three or four leaders of departments, you're impeding your ability to innovate and to make the best decisions. Because there's so many decisions to make, right? Like you could never make, you know, that many thousands of decisions that well, but if you distribute it and have people who really understand what's going on and empower them to come up with ideas and know which decisions they can make on their own. And if they need, and if it affects a bunch of people, like to make sure that they're collaborating with those people. And if you can distribute decisions across your organization, you unlock, most nonprofits say, what is their biggest problem? They say money. But every nonprofit that I look at, their biggest issue is they have all this untapped human capacity. And it barely takes any money or no money at all to start untapping that. Like every person in your nonprofit, and nonprofits are full of people between board members and staff members and volunteers. There are plenty of people to go around. But most nonprofits aren't organized, so they're like leveraging everybody's brain. And if you could start leveraging everybody's brain right now in your nonprofit, your money problems would probably be gone, first of all. And everything would start, you'd gain so much more momentum very, very quickly.
Absolutely. There's a lot of people in the military that do this well, and there's some that maybe don't do it as well. But you're trying to empower the leadership at every level. When you look at it in an organizational chart, you have, you know, the big wig at the top, and then you've got maybe a couple of department heads, and you've got their branch representatives below them and on down the thing. The really good leaders that I've seen, they take the organizational chart and they flip it over like you guys already know what to do. Okay. I'm here at the bottom of the pyramid supporting you guys on top. Whatever you need, we'll be there to support you, help remove roadblocks, and we're going to empower you to make decisions at whatever level. Now I'm going to, you know, retain the right to make the decisions on these five things. Like if it hits one of these things, and the military is great about it because they say you will not give away the right to these five things, right? These are things that get the commanding officer fired. But like, keep me up to date on these. I retain the right to make the final decisions on A, B, to C. I need to be notified on these 10 things. But below that, you guys are qualified. You guys are well-trained to go take action. If it's within your lane, right? If I've given you the quote unquote power to do that or make the decision, go do it. Like don't wait for me here. And what that might look like in the nonprofit world is you mentioned guiding principles. I'll let you get into that a little bit more, but it may be like, look, if it saves us money or makes us money, do it and bring it up in the next meeting. Tell me how it went. If you need a little stick and rudder, if you need a little guidance, I'll give it to you. But leadership, we make this thing so hard, right? The leader goes to his people like, have they been trained? Are they capable? Have I given them my direction? Do they know what I want? Have I told them? I mentioned this a lot, but you know, Jim Mattis's 3-step communication process. What do I know? Who needs to know? Have I told them? Have I given them my expectations? Have I set them? And then let them go do it. It's the 3 D's of leadership: delegate, delegate, and disappear. do this, go do this, and I'm going to leave because I'm not going to sit here and watch you do it because that doesn't help anybody. But make sure they're trained. Make sure they know what to do. Make sure they have the capacity to do it. Give them your expectations and let them go. And if they come to you for a little bit of guidance to help get them down the rail, give it to them. But they need to be learning and doing and trying to figure some of this stuff out because that process is what's going to make them stronger, what's going to make the organization stronger, and it's going to make you look like a better leader. If you have to know every detail about everything that's going on, why even have a team? You're just going to do it all yourself.
That's right. And you're going to be like cutting off your own feet. You're going to be strangling the growth of your organization, and you'll end up like a lot of my clients before I work with them. I love working with those nonprofits who are really stuck. And boy, have I heard some doozies of stories. You know, my favorite this year was just before COVID, almost a year ago. It was end of February, a year ago. I met this executive director. She's the only quote employee, except she wasn't getting paid. She was on the board because she had to be, because there were only two other board members. The founder was on the board and a friend. And those two people wanted to leave, but they couldn't because they had to all three be on the board. But they had this really important nonprofit. They're involved with feeding hungry people. And so, you know, like they weren't going to stop, but they were stuck. And this executive director was worried about, you know, can I go further? Am I now just like, you know, I can't just go on forever not paying myself. You know, I'm reaching my limit. They were a sinking ship. You know, in their mind, they were stuck. In my mind, I'm like, you guys are sinking fast. And then, you know, we put these things in place. And like roughly six months later, the money just started coming in, right? And the impact method doesn't specifically, it's not a fundraising method, but almost every time, like it fixes the money problem. As soon as somebody's accountable for paying attention to it and the outcomes for it, then that comes around. And when the organization is clear about who they are. So around 6 months in, the money started coming in like crazy for this nonprofit. And actually, before the money started coming in, we came up with a strategy. The nonprofit, the ED, started paying herself. So she's paying herself less than 6 months. 6 months in, the money's coming in. And shortly after that, she hires an assistant, you know, almost full time. And then as soon as that's in place, now everything else is working way better. Her board has grown. So, you know, we're now, she's just coming up on a year later. And I mean, the growth has been amazing. And I say growth, but what I really mean is scale, because wow, her organization is doing more. Her team is bigger. Her board is bigger. She's paying herself. She's more relaxed. She has more time back in her day. She's not feeling quite so overwhelmed and stressed out as she were. So that's what we really want is scale, right? Because growth isn't sustainable like scale is. Scale means we can do 10 times more and it's 2 times more the effort. We can do 20 times more and maybe it's 4 times more the effort. Maybe it's only 3 times the effort of when we were doing 10 times. But if the work of it grows with the growth, that's not scaling. You're just creating a bigger monster. You're just creating more overwhelm, more money problems. And a lot of the nonprofits I meet, because they haven't addressed this like human capacity issue, if you were to say like, sure, I'll solve your money problems, I'll give you all this money, they would be in the same kind of trouble, but a bigger version of trouble within a very short amount of time, because they wouldn't know how to leverage it to scale their impact.
What you said without saying it is something that I've known for a long time. And a lot of people have known for a long time, but not everyone's learned this yet. Money is never the problem.
That's right.
Money is a symptom of a problem. Money is never the problem. People are like, well, if I just made more money, like, look, if you can't get by on 90% of your income, then 120% of your income is not going to fix the problem. The same with nonprofits. If $10,000 a year is not enough, then $15,000 a year is not going to solve it. And they're like, well, what do you mean? It's $5,000 more. I'm like, the problem was never the money. I've got tons of nonprofits bringing in tons of money and they're stressed to the max and they're wore out and they're tired and they don't know why. And I'm like, well, how much are you paying yourself? And you're like, well, I shouldn't get paid. No, that's something you've decided that you want to believe in, but that's not a true statement. And like, well, you have all these nonprofits around making all this kind of money. That's just not right. According to who? According to what? why should someone not be paid for the talents that they bring to the table? Why should this not work out this way? I'm like, the top nonprofits.
Why should the staff have to be, on food stamps or have a second job just to be able to afford to help somebody else? Any nonprofit who's putting their team in a position that they need to rely on another nonprofit or their own nonprofit, that's not really helping. And I am such a firm believer that actually the better your team is taken care of, the more people they can actually help. So it feels safe to say, oh, we're not going to spend money on these things. But it is not safe. One of the examples I love from one of my favorite authors, Margaret Wheatley, who's actually very well known for doing some great consulting with the military. And she's a big systems thinker. And she talks about, what we can learn from science and apply it to organizations. And she talks about in thermodynamics, we have this, I think it's thermodynamics, this concept of entropy, right? Mm-hmm. So something that is just, right? So that's just giving off energy is actually shrinking, right? And that's what a lot of nonprofits are doing. They think they're being safe and being still, but they're still giving off energy. So they're actually shrinking or sinking, as I like to think of it, because I like the boat analogy. And so they don't realize that they're actually doing something that's dangerous. They're putting their missions and the people they serve at risk by being so afraid to spend money or try something different or innovate. And it's not just because of them, right? We have this cultural thing going on that tells nonprofits, like, it should feel hard, right? It's better if it feels hard. You should be sacrificing yourself, right? But that's not true. You got to put your own mask on first.
That's not true at all. So Dan Pallotta talks about this in his TED Talk, where he talks about money and nonprofits. And he mentions that it was like this Puritan thing that when we came over, yes, you could earn money in business, but earning money was quote unquote evil. So in order to pay penance, you would do nonprofit work and you should be suffering while you do it. This is a made up thing. We just decided it was a thing one day and we've been going with it. I hate just going with it. The people that like know me in my inner circle, they love me, right? But I'm challenging, because when they talk about something and something's going on in their world, I challenge that assumption, that talk, that like, why should this be painful? Why should you not be making money? Well, if I'm making money, I'm taking away from services, right? Yes, but you're not, because if you're not sustainable, if what you're doing is not sustainable, AKA you're getting paid enough to do it, then you're going to not be providing services, what, a year from now, 2 years from now, three, how long before you burn out? Like, oh, burnout, that's for, pansies. Burnout's for people that aren't prepared, that aren't taking care of the life cycle of what we all go through, no matter what the job is, whether that's working for a company, you're in the military, academia, or in a nonprofit world. You have to be able to take care of the system. You have to refill your cup. You have to put on your own mask first, all of those things. And if you're not in this sustainable place and you're doing something like feeding the homeless, like we brought up earlier, you're going to burn out, not have a process in place. And all of a sudden these people aren't getting fed. Now, are you being selfish or are you being self-sacrificing? Which one is it? Because it's a distinction. And I know I've spoken about this before, and some people that have been listening for a long time are like, Travis, we know, I can't believe it. But this comes up all the time, which is why I feel the need to continue talking about it. If you're not sustainable, it doesn't matter what you're providing.
That's right. Because you're not, when you shut down, you are not helping anybody.
Yeah,
and the truth is, I don't just want both for nonprofit leaders, like I think you do too, because I've seen what has happened to many of them, but I know that it's better, right? It's better, a refreshed, not overwhelmed nonprofit leader. And at whatever level, I say leader, but I think of nonprofit leaders as everybody, because most nonprofits their missions involve solving very complex, previously unsolved problems, right? You're solving something that's complex and previous and has never been solved before, right? You cannot do that without innovation. And you can't do innovation without a fresh mind that can be creative, that has enough extra wiggle room. You can't just be in the day-to-day. You have to be running experiments. You have to have enough room for lots of those experiments to fail or be less good, right? And only people who have extra time in their day are able to be great innovators. In fact, the way, you know, like, or companies like Google and stuff are masters of innovation, they give their people lots of time to just goof off or explore something, you know, then they go through great lengths to, like, you know, providing, you probably heard, like, they provide their meals and their laundry, right? Just to give them more of that time so that they can innovate for Google, right? And innovation is what's going to solve those extremely complex, not previously solved problems. So unless your organization is doing something that maybe in fact doesn't really need to be done because it's already been figured out, then you have to be this way. You have to have extra time in your day and you have to be well rested and you have to make enough money and you have to have a big enough team, or you're not going to solve that problem. And essentially you are just running on one of those rat wheels and you're not really making the impact that you could be.
Oh, absolutely. I've got a friend of mine, a great mentor, and actually he's been a guest on the show, Stephen Kuhn, talks about creating space. When you go into a meeting where you're in this group of people and you're there providing value without expectation, you allow people to step into your into their greatness. And that's the only way we're going to solve some of these unsolvable problems. And I say unsolvable, just currently not yet solved, right?
not yet solved.
They're not unsolvable, right? There's things out there, and you come across things like Upstream by Dan Heath, where he talks about the organization that I think is Community Partnership. I'm probably saying it wrong because I haven't researched it before I'm talking about it. But he talks about like the 18 cities in the U.S. that are functionally homeless. They're at functional zero. They have more housing available than there are homeless people on the streets. And when you talk to someone that hasn't come across this concept, like, well, it's impossible. Well, if it's impossible, why are you putting all your time, energy, and effort into it if you don't believe in it? A. And B, when you're presented with the solution, why are you stiff-arming it up front? The only way we're going to come into some of these things, if you allow the people in your organization, in your inner circle, give them the space they need to step into this thing and come up with innovate something new. Because that's the stuff that we've got is just not cutting it. It's getting closer, but just because we're putting more effort into something and maybe going through that martyr syndrome that I'm talking about, where we feel like we have to be in pain, more effort doesn't equal better outcomes.
That's absolutely true. One of my favorite, I think they're called Give Directly. I should really memorize it because I reference them all the time. They run experiments, charitable experiments. They run programs where they essentially just give cash to people who are in some way economically disadvantaged. And then they run experiments comparing the outcomes of just giving people money, right? So they have really low overhead because they're not trying to provide like a caseworker and a this and that and follow up with people. They just be like, here's cash. And what they have found, you can go to their website and look at their research studies where they compare other programs that are trying to get the same outcomes for the same people. And not every time, but many times, their programs are more effective and they're also cheaper. But a lot of people are like, huh, we're just going to give poor people money and we're not going to like make them jump through all these hoops to get it. And actually, turns out what they've shown essentially again and again is if you just give people money who are in need, for the most part, they spend it where they need it most. And all the so-called interventions to help make sure they spend it where they need it most aren't actually increasing their ability to get out of their situation and become self-sustaining. And that, like, I love that organization. I like to look at their studies because it goes against this like whole idea of martyrdom and overcomplicating things, right? But it takes a brave and rested and, you know, person stepping into their greatness to say, you know, well, what if we just did this? Well, let's try it and measure it and see what happens. But that goes against what we're told, what the nonprofit community is told again and again.
Yeah, you have to challenge those assumptions. That book by Dan Heath, the organization is Community Solutions. And I think their program is called Built for Zero, where they're talking about this stuff. And they take a multidisciplinary approach. They cover and canvas the neighborhood, like, and they turn people in, not in, from numbers into people. Not, you know, have you seen homeless person number one? And like, hey, Sarah's been on my mind. Sarah, we were tracking Sarah. Was she, like, has she been to your Italian store? No. I haven't seen her in a couple of weeks. Oh, actually, we got her into housing over here. Cool. And now Sarah is taken care of. And Sarah is on this list, not, you know, the 15,000 homeless people we have. Where's Dan? Where's Sarah? Where's Travis? Who's seeing them last? Are they okay? What are they doing? And when you get this multidisciplinary study approach and you turn numbers into people, all of a sudden you start actually taking care of the problem and you're taking care of it upstream instead of where it is just at the end of the whip. And the end of the whip feels better because you're actually doing things. I actually helped 6 people this month.
Right.
Right. But that doesn't solve the core problem. Again, the money is not the problem. The money is a symptom. Them being hungry and homeless is not the problem. It's a symptom of the problem. So they're finding things like a city covering rent for 2 months is a much lower strain on the whole system to cover, I don't know, $2,400 a month or $2,400 in rent for 2 months to keep a family in their home instead of kicking them out and expecting, you know, this family of 4 has to be supported by all these other programs. So it's cheaper.
Yeah.
It's more efficient and it keeps their numbers low, which is wonderful.
Yeah, I've worked with a lot of organizations who deal with mental health, substance abuse, and homelessness. And it's a complex problem, partly because of all the regulations and loopholes and weird things that happen because policymakers, not people on the ground, are setting the constraints for who gets money. But usually it's like this, not very complex, but interwoven problem of you can't get sober easily if you're homeless, right? How are you supposed to get sober if you're homeless? And in fact, how are you supposed to be homeless and survive the pain of walking around all day and being out in the cold if you're not somehow, you know, taking some sort of pain relief? Like, it is really hard to even remain a sober person if you're homeless. So sobriety and substance use are, not sorry, homelessness and substance use are so closely intertwined. And then how can you get a job if you're homeless, right? If you smell, if your clothes are dirty, you're not going to pass that job interview, right? So much actually comes down with all these things to a housing problem. Someone who has a secure, safe place to live can get sober, can get a job, right? So there's a lot, but yet there is a lot of money for housing, right? Subsidized housing. But for most of that money, you can't get it if you're not sober.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's where the problem gets complex. Or I knew here in New York State, we had this issue come up. You could get money to get people in a program to become sober, whatever kind of sober definition is. And you could get money for a sober homeless person to get housing, but you couldn't go from the rehab right into the housing. On paper, at least, you had to make the person homeless for at least 10 days before they would qualify to getting into housing. This stuff is real. What? I am not making it up. And that is why this problem is so hard to solve.
I know we just got you sober. Come back to me in 10 days after we've made you homeless again. Hopefully not in the bottle. But then if you're still sober, if you pass our test, then we're going to give you housing.
Yeah. What were they thinking? And the thing is, they aren't thinking at the, when these things come down from really high level policymakers who really don't see what's going on the ground, then we don't get good solutions. And I'm going to bring that back to the leadership thing and the impact method, because so, you know, one of the mind blowing things, I'll just say, you know, the impact method is different for a lot of organizations, because all that stuff about boards being told you're in charge of strategic direction, I say no. The people in the nonprofit who are doing the work day to day need to be the ones who are determining strategic direction, because they're the ones who understand the true nature of the problems. And they're the ones who have, I'll call it the food or the nourishment to generate better ideas about how to solve it. A volunteer board member who's showing up and learning what's kind of going on once a month is just not going to have that kind of understanding that the hands on people. So I really advocate boards should play a governance role of checking, double checking, right? Does this make sense? Can you explain it to us? Does it make sense? Yes. Awesome. No, go fix that. Right. And oh, you still haven't fixed it. You still haven't fixed it. Then be like, hey, what's going on here? Right. If there's no good explanation. But to think that a board would even begin to have the ability to decide, you know, where things need to go, I think is just an unreasonable expectation. And when you can empower the people on the ground, those, especially the direct care workers, are my favorite. You can get amazing and oftentimes really simple solutions to problems, right? The people who don't have their hands on the reality tend to overcomplicate the solutions. Like, and we'll do this, and we'll do that, and we'll do this, and we'll do that. But we take it back to the, like, the sobriety thing, or we'll just get everybody housing for 6 months or a year.
This is an engineer versus a maintainer problem, right? We have potable water on the airplane, drinking water. And there's a valve, fill overflow valve. It's how you service the airplane to give the system the water it needs for the people in flight. There was a problem overextending these valves. It would turn too much. And the engineers were like, how can we fix the valve? This and that, blah, 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 blah. Big, complicated, expensive. And we came up with, well, what if we put like a little metal tab right here? It weighs like 1.5 ounces, takes 2 rivets. You can install it in moments, right? Just a few moments, go out there and do this. And then the tail can't turn that far. It's a physical barrier. Can't do it. We implemented this on a couple of airplanes. We went into the engineering conference where they talk about this stuff. And I was like, well, we just did this and it fixed the problem and it doesn't change aerodynamics, weight and balance, any of the stuff that, you know, aviation engineers really care about. What do you guys think? And they were like, son of a bitch. Like, we had all these ideas and internal workings of the valve and this and that. But if you stay back and you look at the people that are right there, you know, apologies for the language, but they were like, really? Like, I can't believe the solution was this simple. When you can either push something or you can pull something, it can go both directions to get closer to the answer. And if you're not including people that are boots on the ground or the direct care workers, you're missing the opportunity to get a solution that's actionable, relatable, reliable, easy to implement. If the senators, it sounds like in New York, spent even a day or two talking to the workers on the ground implementing these homeless solutions, they'd have been like, oh, of course, that makes perfect sense. And then the bills and the law wouldn't suck and create an extra barrier.
That's
you have to include.
Unfortunately, the bills and the law do, and the Department of Housing and the Department of actually, even the Department of Mental Health Services and Addiction Services, separate department. Housing is separate department. And they, you know, it's still not official, but they all have something to do with each other.
Well, see, that's what I'm talking about upstream, like for most of this episode here. But that's the solution to the homeless problem as described in the book. The folks at Community Solutions work interdepartmentally.
Right.
Through across the departments that we're talking about right now to solve the problem. And then they go boots on ground and talk to local business owners and be like, hey, have you been feeding Sarah leftovers at the end of the day? Well, actually, she got housing and now they're off the list and they're moving around. But we've talked about processes of improvements. We talked a little bit about modus operandi. What about actionable strategy? What does that look like?
So, you know, having an action, I've heard the story just too many times, although I keep hearing it. We did a strategic plan and then we put it on the shelf. So, you know, we could talk about, well, how do I even go about solving that problem? First of all, it was something you can put on a shelf, right? Like, how are you supposed to keep anything that you can put on a shelf alive? Like, I read a book and I put it on the shelf, or it's on my like e-reader. That is not a living thing. And we need our strategies if we're going to achieve the goals in them to be living things. So how do we do that, right? So the way we do it in the impact method is, one, the way we set our goals, we have a really structured process of how to set goals. And I actually have a free workbook on this. I'll give you the link for the show notes about how we set goals. But the basic idea is we always separate the outcome from the action, from not just the action. So we look at the outcome that we're trying to achieve, which is something we can't control, like make Mary not homeless, right? There are too many variables in there for us. We can't force her into a house. But then there's what I call them execution goals. The academics who study goals actually call these process goals. There's the goal that we do have control over. Provide housing that Mary can afford, right? So the outcome that we're going for is give Mary, you know, a nice, not give her, have Mary have sustainable housing, right? The action that we can control, the goal that we can control is to provide housing, have adequate housing for everybody that's affordable. So those are the two pieces, right? Every goal actually has these two pieces, the outcome and the part that we have control over. Once you know the part you have control over and you've separated the mystery out, then you can create a set of projects that you can do to try to achieve the result that you basically have control over. So if the goal is to provide, you know, X number of affordable housing units in this city, you know, we could buy X number of buildings. We could, you know, apply for X number of grants. There's, you know, a number of things you could do. You could research what Mary wants in a house, right? It's not just have the housing available. It's got to be housing Mary wants to live in. We could make sure that each housing unit is furnished, right? There's lots of stories.
Here's a shanty by the river in a bad part of town. I don't understand what the problem is. We've provided you a home.
Right. There's a story sticks out to me of a mother with her son coming out of a battered woman's shelter, and they provided her an apartment with a mattress on the floor and a lamp. And she spent the first, you know, so many months with her son just sleeping on a mattress on the floor she had a lamp, a standing lamp. And she was actually starting a nonprofit of her own because saying, you know, to bring yourself out of that place of abuse, you need more than just an empty apartment, right? You can't make your son feel safe with an empty, you know, a plain mattress and a lamp. You need a little bit of furniture. You need some clothes, right? It takes a little more to overcome that experience and stand on your own feet. So, right, so you can have all these projects in place to try to reach that goal. Once you have projects, you're ready to have project management, right? You can break those projects down into tasks that people can do. So in the impact method, we usually use a digital tool where this is like digitally all connected. Big outcome goal with a line to it. We use a mind map actually for the high level strategic plan with the mission at the middle and then the outcomes stemming out. And then we work each tree until we're at an execution type goal, something we have control over. And then in the execution goal, we now have a list of projects. And then inside each project, which is owned by a single person, then there's all the tasks that go on with those projects. Mm-hmm. Now we connect that back to the process of improvement. And guess what? You're checking in on the status of each of those projects that you're currently working on every 2 weeks so they don't slip through the cracks. And you're adjusting them live as needed. And you're adjusting those strategic goals every 2 months. So now when we combine an actionable strategy with a process of improvement, we have a true living system of setting goals, taking action, seeing the results, right? The world moves too fast to like hire Bridgespan and do like a, you know, several $100,000 research project and then tell you, okay, now do this. Because by the time they delivered you that and you figured out how you can even do this project, it's probably irrelevant, right? Yeah, so the best way to work in this fast world is to take action and observe the results of your own behavior and then immediately adjust your action and observe the results after a certain amount of time.
Yeah, this is actually in alignment with what the military does. So we have the strategic level, which is, you know, think White House and Pentagon level. You've got the operational level, which think you're different. You're called geographic combatant commanders. Really, they're the commander in a certain area of the world, right? To get dive that down, you've got the tactical level in the Navy. That's the ships and boats that are actually ships, boats, and planes that are actually executing the mission and doing the stuff. So at the strategic level, you have this kind of vision. You've got this expectation level, like the Secretary of Defense might have, you know, let's keep the nation safe from A, B, and C. Well, A, B, and C, those people or entities or whatever they are, they become the focus of the operational level plan. So operation, I have all these things available to me to create an operational plan that meets the boss's intent, the commander's intent, the executive director's intent, the founder's intent, whatever this looks like for you. How are we going to take their priorities and the thing that they care about, and what are we going to put into action? And this is the difference between the strategic plan on the shelf and what we're implementing, what you're talking about with the implant pack method. You're saying, you guys are responsible for executing this, 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 and this. And then those people with their teams are actually the tactical level of actually doing the stuff. And it sounds like you've got all that covered with the impact method. So bravo to that. I had someone else on that I kind of really kind of critiqued him on the air. I feel like there's a piece missing in here. Like you haven't assigned, like when you do the planning, especially for the military, you have your objective, right? And then you have something called, I forget what it's called, but it's a task associated to a purpose, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to interview Sarah Oliveira in order to, that's the transition, the task. What I'm doing, I'm going to interview Sarah in order to make sure Pivot Ground can talk about their impact method and what they do and how they help nonprofits. So it's not that I'm just going to do a task. I'm not just going to interview Sarah. Why am I interviewing Sarah? What's the purpose? Okay. And how, and does that align with military, the commander's intent, the mission, the principles, the goal, or the nonprofit? Does this align with my mission? Does this align with our guiding principles? Is this moving the needle forward in our area? And if whatever task you come up with isn't in alignment with that, then you don't do it. It is not on the board. You take it off, you throw it away. That's a great task that needs to be done. But if you can't align it with a purpose behind it, a task and a purpose, if you can't do that, well, then you've got nothing. Then you're just busy doing busy work. And I know Sarah's seen this. I know I've seen this. You come across someone that's doing so much stuff, but none of it moves the mission forward because it's just extraneous stuff. It's just being busy. And being busy is like that martyr syndrome. It's not a badge of courage. Really, it's a badge of stupidity and I'm not trying to attack anybody here, but if you're just busy and nothing's happening, you're busy in the wrong areas. Shawshank, get busy living or get busy dying. Get busy in the areas that need your attention that actually move the mission forward. If you've got a world-class whiz-bang fundraiser and this person is handwriting thank you notes or putting things into a database, you're probably wasting their time, talent, and treasure, and they're going to leave you soon. The turnover rate for executive directors and finance fundraisers are very high, because they're doing all this extra extraneous garbage that they don't need to be wasting their time with, because you haven't figured out a better way to do it. Figure out the better, easier way to do it. Give the task to somebody else and let them operate in their zone of genius and really have an impact and move the needle forward.
Two things related to that. One is, you know, for those who don't know, you know, but I have not, it seems that all elements of the military, military is fantastic. And I'm sure each, you know, area would argue that they're better, but we'll leave that to those folks to argue. But I am always impressed with the forward-thinking nature of the military. They work with the most forward-thinking people who are figuring out how to do things better. They are, I mean, especially if you think of all the military together. That is a huge, it's multiple institutions. That's like a massive amount of people and structures and power. And they are doing everything they can to be nimble and effective, right? And just like in nonprofits, the cost of not being effective is very high. Very, very high. And unfortunately, you know, they do this work and you have learned, like, and this didn't happen overnight. The military like works so hard at being better and better and better at these things and adapting as, you know, technology changes and ability changes. So, and I know some of my inspiration for creating the impact method came from professionals who spent a lot of time working with the military on how to do things better. So it comes as no surprise. And it's really such an honor to hear that you're hearing those things. For me, the challenge was not coming up with these kind of great ideas, because they're frankly not that original. What I did was I put it in nonprofit language and I simplified it to a point that was actionable for a nonprofit that was already overwhelmed. because some systems, you know, are good, but you have to have enough capacity to implement them. And most nonprofits, they don't even have the capacity to implement change because they're so overwhelmed. And so I knew I had to really make it actionable. And, you know, to go back to, you know, why do people, they end up with all this extra stuff on their plates. And my favorite thing as a kind of coach to do is like, oh, just stop doing that and just stop doing that. Best way to get time back on your plate, even better than delegating, even better than automating, is just stop doing it completely. Just not doing it anymore. But once you have a process like I described and like you described to help you decide what to do and not to do, you're no longer saying, well, do we like doing this? That's like the kiss of death. Do we like doing it? Or does it, you know, we should or we shouldn't, right? The only thing is, does this activity get the result we're looking for? No, it was an awesome idea. It's just not the right idea for this. And so we're not going to do it because it's not getting the results. And it almost gives people permission to like take things off their plate. It gives them, well, it just doesn't get the results. Nobody's fault. You know, it's just reality.
Not aligned if it's not moving the needle. I mean, you could should yourself to death. And if you do it enough, you might should your pants. Get rid of that. We should. What are we doing? Is it moving it forward? Does it matter to the mission? If not, get rid of it. There's so many things like we learned during COVID, especially in the military. We had, let me tell you, the meeting schedule was ridiculous. You know what we found is that we're still able to do everything we're doing with much less meetings or much less in-person meetings. We're able to zoom in to the conference where stuff has to go off and the commander has to get his information. Great. But instead of being stuck in a room, just sitting there with a notepad, you're at your desk and working. And then when it's your turn to talk, you give the 30-second to 3-minute spiel with the boss that he needs. And you haven't lost any work time because you've been at your desk the whole time doing the things that you need to be doing. It's been great for that. We've got rid of so many extraneous things. It's fantastic. But I love that you were able to come on today. Love you talked about the impact method. We talked about the process of improvement, actionable strategy, the fantastic modus operandi. We talked about the cycle, the sprint, the issues. We talked about Dan Heath and Upworks working multidisciplinary, cross-functionary. We've talked about guiding principles over core values that really vision for the future, what leadership looks like, how to implement this stuff when you're already busy and overwhelmed. Thank you for coming on and representing Pivot Ground and what you're doing and talking to us about the impact method. Where can people find you?
Sure. The best place is go to pivotground.com. You can also find me on Facebook and LinkedIn. Those are good places. Technically, I'm on Twitter, but I'm not really on Twitter. So don't go looking for me there.
yeah, I'm technically on Twitter too. Let's be honest. I'm not on Twitter.
But if you go to pivotground.com, you can see more things about the impact method, other things we do. And there's also an apply for a call button. If you'd like to have a free one-on-one call with me, you are welcome to do that. While supplies last, I'll warn you, my calendar has been filling up. So if you would like that, don't be shy. Don't hesitate. Just book a call. And it might not be for a couple of weeks, but we will talk one-on-one.
Thanks so much, Sarah.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.